From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, Nelson Peary's Quiet Revolution. Nelson Peary is a black man who grew up poor during the Depression, but he didn't want to surrender to the demoralization that was stifling everyone he knew. As a young man, he left home, became a hobo, and saw America by hopping freights. During World War II, he enlisted in the segregated army to fight for the kind of justice and freedom which were denied him at home. Peary's memoir is called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Disclosure, starring Michael Douglas and Demi Moore. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. The White House says Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders has resigned. Elders has drawn criticism from conservatives on various issues, including suggesting that the government consider legalizing drugs and supporting schools that distribute contraceptives to students. President Clinton's press secretary says Mr. Clinton spoke with Elders after his speech today at the Hemispheric Summit in Miami. No official reason has been offered for Elders' resignation. Defense Secretary William Perry says the Pentagon is cutting or delaying a number of big-ticket weapons programs to reach its target for budget cuts. But Perry says the goal was easier to reach since President Clinton announced that he was adding $25 billion to the military budget.
The Pentagon anticipated that the cuts in modernizations could be as high as $20 billion. But the president's decision and new inflation assumptions have made our job much easier. The savings I'm announcing today are much less, in particular the $7.7 billion in previously planned modernization spending over the next 6 years.
The cuts include reductions in spending on the Air Force's F-22 stealth attack jet, the Army's Comanche helicopter, and the Navy's new attack submarine. Perry says the Pentagon will produce slightly fewer of the V-22 tilt-rotor helicopters for the Marines and Special Operations Forces. Representatives of the British government and Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, met openly today for the first time. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports from London.
The meeting took place at Belfast's Stormont Castle, former home of the Northern Ireland Parliament and symbol of Protestant unionism. The Sinn Féin delegation, headed by Deputy President Martin McGuinness, met with a group of middle-level British government representatives for more than 3 hours, longer than anticipated. Items discussed included the removal of British troops from Northern Ireland and the decommissioning of IRA arms. Sinn Féin's McGuinness called the meeting an historic opportunity which needs to be built upon. Britain's Northern Ireland Minister Michael Ancram said the talks had been businesslike and constructive. Both sides agreed to meet again December 19th. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Federal aviation officials say they are banning two models of commuter planes from flying in icy conditions, the ATR-42 and the ATR-72. An American Eagle ATR crashed in Indiana in October in icy weather, killing all 68 people aboard, and some of the commuter line's pilots recently refused to fly the craft in icy conditions. PLO chief Yasser Arafat has arrived in Oslo, Norway, where he'll receive the Nobel Peace Prize, which he is sharing with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 2.5 points. The Nasdaq is down 2.5 points also. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin ordered his government today to disarm the rebels in the breakaway province of Chechnya. The order to use all measures available to the state seems to increase the likelihood of overt military intervention. In the Chechen capital, residents expecting war have started building fortifications, and volunteers have been joining local militias. Russian troops are massed at the borders of Chechnya, which declared independence 3 years ago. A gathering of African-American leaders convened twice before amid controversy is meeting again this weekend in Chicago. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
This national African-American leadership summit may be able to gather in relative peace and quiet. Last August in Baltimore, the meeting of political activists, scholars, religious, and business leaders coincided with the ouster of summit convener Benjamin Chavis from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Chavis, whom his supporters believe was forced from the NAACP leadership largely because of his outreach to black nationalists, is scheduled to attend the gathering in Chicago. So is Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, whose presence at previous summits generated criticism from white and black civil rights advocates. Other summit participants say that it is their right to meet with whomever they wish for an exchange of ideas about the economic, political, and spiritual direction of African American communities. The summit continues through Sunday. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
Senator Bob Kerry proposed today that the retirement age be raised to 70 to ease the strain on the federal budget. The Nebraska Democrat is co-chairman of the Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. He hopes to persuade a majority of the panel to accept the plan, but he faces tough opposition. The AFL-CIO, the American Association of Retired Persons, and other groups have already come out against it. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, an interview Terry recorded last summer with Nelson Peary.
Nelson Peary experienced a kind of American life that no longer exists. During part of the Depression, he was a hobo. During World War II, he served in the all-black 93rd Infantry Division of the Segregated Army. He writes about these parts of his life in his new memoir, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. After the war, Peary made his living as a bricklayer and worked for several left-wing groups, fighting racism and other forms of injustice. For most of his childhood, he lived with his family in a small, rural Minnesota town called Wabasha. His family was the only black family in town. Here's the story of how they wound up there.
My father, at the end of the war, he wanted to become a lawyer. Now, actually, there weren't many black lawyers in 1918. And he had a hard time doing it. Of course, he was from a working-class family in St. Joe, Missouri. And he tried to do this by going to school at night, but he got married and had a couple kids, and so he took a civil service examination for the mail service, which at that time was the cream of the mail service. That is, the railway mail service. And he passed the examination, and him and another veteran were the first blacks to be accepted in the railway mail service. And the supervisor in St. Joe, Missouri, was absolutely furious about this, and he would not have a black man working in the railway mail service under him. So he was transferred to Minneapolis. We moved up there in 1928, and then my father immediately clashed with the supervisors over racial discrimination, clashed with the supervisors in Minneapolis, and they transferred us to this little town, Wabasha, which is about 80 miles south of Minneapolis. And this was a town where most of the residents had never seen a black before. I think it's necessary to also understand that at that time, the divisions between blacks and whites, in the North especially, was very, very complete. There was real walls between them. There were no communications or no nothing. So they were very, very surprised when we moved in. And a whole new section of my life began at that point. I was about 7 years old.
Tell us just a little bit about what it was like to be the only black family in a small town where they hadn't seen blacks before.
Well, I think the first thing that has to be said is that people are people and kids are kids. And I was about seven at that time. And our main interest was having fun, you know, playing baseball and throwing rocks and going hunting and so forth and so on. And being the only black family, we weren't a threat to anybody. And so basically speaking, at that age especially, we just got along fine with everybody. There was fights, there was name-calling and this sort of thing, and we got into fights, and after the fight was over, shook hands and continued on what you were doing. By and large, I would say that the period I spent in Wabasha was a very, basically a happy time. And it was fundamentally a schoolroom for me, for the way I would approach human beings for the rest of my life.
Your father wanted to move to a bigger place. He wanted to move to Minneapolis. So he
right.
requested a transfer. And I love the letter that you quote. It's, he said in this letter requesting the transfer that his sons were reaching puberty and they were beginning to associate with white girls. And he was sure that the Postmaster General was as opposed to this as he was. What a strange way to have to ask for a transfer.
Well, because he'd asked for a transfer every year, and it was never even considered. That letter actually went to President Roosevelt.
Really?
And the Postmaster General, of course, stopped it and immediately agreed to the transfer.
Is this because they were so concerned, too, about him having sons who were associated with white girls?
Absolutely. At that period of time, that was where the line was drawn. And, of course, they understood. I think everybody understood you couldn't put seven black youngsters in an all-white town without them ending up having white girlfriends. I mean, there were no other women available, right? So that was something that they simply would not tolerate. So we got that transfer out of Wabasha immediately.
Actually, your father was very worried about one of you ending up like the Scottsboro boys, unjustly accused of rape of a white girl.
Yes, that was always a fear. You didn't have to do anything in America to be lynched or to be beaten up or sent to prison. You didn't have to be guilty of anything. It's all you had to be is black. And he was very afraid of this isolation. He was also afraid that sooner or later, some of his boys were going to get involved with these white girls, and their parents might object to it, and then there was going to be problems. As matters stood, no one ever objected to anything, but there was always that threat hanging over us.
So what was the most striking change for you going from a small town to Minneapolis?
Well, I think for the first time I was thrown in with a group of black kids my own age who spoke differently and to some degree thought differently than I did. That, you know, when I met them, to shake hands and say hi there, you know, it was something kind of strange to them. I know we were called hayseeds from the minute that we moved to Minneapolis, that we were looked upon as being very strange young people. But we fit in very quickly and very quickly, you know, found our place in the corner grouping, what we call gangs, you know, which we didn't do anything more than stand around and talk with each other. But we fit in very quickly, I think. I don't think there's any real transitional problems, although there was certain changes that me and my brothers had to make in order to completely fit in.
Like what?
I mean, we had to learn different ways of expressing ourselves. We had to learn. We had to gain different objectives, so to speak, and cultural objectives. We had to learn to like different kind of music. We had to learn to dance and so forth and so on, something I never did, incidentally.
You probably had to learn to stop saying hi there also.
Yeah, we had to stop saying hi.
The year before you graduated high school, you jumped a boxcar and became a hobo for a while. And you write that you really needed to get away. What was behind that urge?
Well, the first part of it was, I think, that there was such a terrible contradiction between the life I had lived up until I was about 15 and the life I lived between 15 and 17. And that is to say, at my earlier stage of development there in Wabasha, I always took it for granted that sky was the limit, that if I did well in school and if I kept my, so to speak, kept my nose clean and obeyed the law and was a decent human being, that I would be able to go as far as I wanted to go. It became painfully clear by the time I was 17 years old that the mop and the cleaning the toilets and carrying the coal and these menial tasks was about as far as any of us were going to get. That it was not only was there a depression going on, but the racial barriers were very, very strict at that time. And there were very few of the blacks that were able to get past those barriers. Now, there some did. But most of them that did so because they had very powerful white friends.
Did the hobo's life seem like a good alternative to you?
No, but it's one of those things that once you get started, you can't hardly extract yourself from it. That the hobo's life is a terrible life. It's dangerous, it's dirty and filthy, it's full of hunger and self-doubt and so forth and so on. It's a terrible life, but at the same time, you're free. Right. If you don't like where you're at, grab a hold of a freight train and go someplace else. And that kind of freedom, I think, gets into the blood of people. And once they get addicted to that kind of a life, they simply can't stop it because they can't knuckle in and knuckle under to authority anymore. But it was a very great experience for me because, again, I learned more of my own people by being a hobo. I learned more of America, her beauty, her viciousness, her kindness. I learned a whole different America than what I had known before.
There had been a hobo jungle near your home in Wabasha.
Yes.
What did you see of hobos from living near the hobo jungle?
Well, to me, they were always a fascinating group of men. We got to kind of realize that the destitute of that year, of that period of time, were a bit different from what you see today. That there was always a hope that they were going to get a job somewhere else, something that kept their human spirit alive. You see amongst the homeless today a certain grinding down and destroying of the human spirit because of the hopelessness of their situation. But everybody felt that somehow or another, around the curve, over the hill, they were going to be able to get a job, and they were going to be able to come out of this kind of a life. But the hobos to us as youngsters were just fascinating. I mean, they were from the farms, they were from the city, they played guitars, they were able to, you know, do lariat tricks. It was a fascinating thing. Just a whole new world was available by that freight train.
One of the hobos put a large E on the side of your house. What did the E mean?
Well, we never really decided. It meant either eats or easy, one or the other. But at any rate, every hobo that came through that area came to our house for something to eat. And, of course, at that period of time, especially the kind of a person my mother was, that no one was ever turned away from our home.
So the E was a sign that your house was a place you could stop.
It was the first place they hit, incidentally, after they got off the freight train. That would be the first house that they got to in Wabasha there. And the word got around, you know, that they were assured of something to eat. Maybe not as much as they would like, but they were always welcome at that house.
Did you find homes like yours when you were a hobo?
Yes, I did. I remember getting into Butte, Montana, to Helena, Montana, which was not a very hospitable place at that time. And I, at that time, been reduced absolutely to destitution. I was absolutely broke. Winter was coming on. I didn't have any warm clothing. And I'd never done this before, but I went to this woman and this home, knocked on the back door and asked this lady if I could do some work for something to eat. And this woman broke out crying. Of course, I was just barely 18 at that time. And she broke out crying and gave me her husband's overcoat and fed me and then prayed with me. And I don't think you'd find that today. I don't think you'd find knocking on the door of a strange person and they would treat you in that manner. There was a whole different psychology in America at that time.
My guest is Nelson Peary, and he's written a memoir called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
Okay, this is Fresh Air. Nelson Peary is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his new memoir, which is his early life. The book is called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. For our listeners who haven't heard the expression hobo jungle, explain what it means.
Well, a hobo jungle was the name that the non-hobos gave to it. They called it a jungle. To the hobos, it was home. The real jungle, it seems to us, was outside of that area. That the real jungle was where the police beat you up, where people threw stones at you, where you were unwelcome, where people talk about they're going to put you on the chain gang if you hang around this town. That was the real jungle. We didn't name the hobo jungle the jungle. For us, it was home.
You say that these places where the hobos lived, I guess near the railroad tracks, they were usually kept pretty clean. Who kept them clean?
Well, we did. I mean, first of all, nobody wants to live in a dirty place. That's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the second place was that you couldn't really live, you couldn't exist, if there was a lot of trash and dangers of fire and all this kind of business. You know? So consequently, when you came into one of these jungles, you found it relatively clean, and you left it relatively clean. Again, I want to say there was a different psychology back in that period of time where people felt that they more or less belonged to wherever they were. And if you were in a jungle, you kind of felt you belonged to it. I've seen many, many times on the road where other hobos had left pots of food, had left pots of coffee for the next person that come along, you know, could get something to eat or drink. And you don't find this today. You don't find this this feeling of solidarity, this feeling of unity. And that didn't happen automatically, incidentally. That was a result of, years of real privation and real destruction of the economic structure. After all, we're talking here about 1939, 1938 period.
What were the vagrancy laws like back then, and what did you need to know in order to not get arrested?
Well, first of all, practically all vagrancy laws stated that you had to have $10 or else you were a vagrant. You had to have $10 or a job or else you were a vagrant. And so every hobo learned that when he got down to his last $10, he was broke, that he didn't spend that money. Now, some of them, of course, had to, and a good number of them went to jail, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days for vagrancy. And incidentally, these laws are still on the books in most places. But today they don't arrest people for vagrancy because there's absolutely no jobs for them to take. But there, the vagrancy laws, at that time, the vagrancy laws had as their purpose to constantly lower the wages, the going rate of wages, by putting pressure on everybody who didn't have a job to take any job at any price. So the situation in that respect has somewhat changed, but it was a vicious law. And it wasn't just men that went to jail on the vagrancy laws. Women, children, anybody who didn't have the $10 or a job, they were a visible means of support. Then they were on their way to jail.
Were you ever arrested for vagrancy?
I was arrested. I was only arrested once in this respect, and that was under a law they call sleeping. That is to say that you couldn't sleep on public property or private property, that you had to sleep on your own property. And I was caught asleep in a railroad yard in North Dakota, at Mobridge, North Dakota. And I was given 3 days, which wasn't too bad. And I served that 3 days, and I learned that I could not go to sleep on railroad property. I could not go to sleep in a park. I could not go to sleep on anybody else's private property without permission. In other words, it was a very dangerous period of time to grow up in.
Well, there must have been places where there was no place to sleep.
That's exactly what it was. There was no place to sleep. So you hid out like an animal. You found some place that looked safe, and you curled up and tried to get a few hours sleep. One thing that characterized being on the road, being a hobo, was that you were absolutely exhausted all the time. You never got a night's sleep.
One of the things you did to make a little bit of money, you took some work at a farm picking peas, but you kept ending up more in debt instead of making any money. Now, how does that happen?
First of all, when they got you onto these big farms that you didn't realize, or at least in the beginning, I didn't realize that I had to pay for the shack that we slept in. Mm-hmm. I had to pay exorbitant prices for bread, for slices of old bologna, or whatever I took from them, with the exception of water, I had to pay for. And a bologna sandwich that cost the employer maybe 4 or 5 cents cost us 25 cents, and that was over an hour's wage. And so you never got ahead. I mean, you had to be a really experienced farm worker in order to make any money over and above your living expenses. And this was true of all kinds of migrant work, not just work in the fields, but other kinds of migrant work were subjected to this kind of thing, too, that these agents of the employers that picked up the hobos and bought them to these various places to work, they made their money by ripping them off in every possible sense of the word.
Now, of course, you couldn't leave until you were even, and it was hard to break even because you were always in debt.
That's right. And when you did go into debt, you generally speaking went into a compound that had barbed wire and dogs. Wow. You couldn't get out.
So how did you finally get out?
Well,
place?
With me, I kept going further and further into debt, or actually what I was doing was about breaking even, but not making enough money to get out of there. And two Japanese young women who were very experienced farm workers gave me a bushel basket of peas, which meant 50 cents, and so that I could get out of there, because both of them understood very well how desperately I wanted to get away from there, and that I just wasn't a pea picker. I didn't know how to do it. And I've always been very deeply indebted to these two young women for handing me over their hard-earned bushel of peas so that I could escape from that semi-slavery of that camp.
Was it physically difficult to hop a train?
Yes, it is. I mean, but most of all, you have to get some sense. You have to learn how to. You have to learn what trains to hop and how to hop them. That it can be very dangerous, and as you can imagine, that hobos were from time to time getting killed by falling between boxcars and being crushed or whatever. But if we were careful, and careful meant, generally speaking, if possible, to get on a train while it was standing still, and if you had to catch it on the run, to know enough not to catch, for example, not to catch the car at the end, because if anything happens, you'd swing between the two cars. So to catch the car at the front of the car. So if something happened, you'd be slammed against the boxcar and just drop to the ground. Little things like that you had to learn in order to be halfway secure in that kind of a life. And there was a lot you had to learn to stay alive there.
What are some of the surprises that awaited you when you actually got into a boxcar?
First of all, I think that not everybody in a boxcar is your friend. I mean, it was on the move that robbing the hobos took place. Like, for example, at the end of a harvest, when the men and women got into these cars, boxcars going to another locale to continue their farm work, they generally had a little bit of money. And that was the time when people robbed them. That was a place where all kinds of bad things could happen. But at the other hand, that was also a place where people shared their cigarettes or shared their tobacco, you know, where they told jokes and laughed and talked about home and so forth. That it was the whole hobo life was one of contradictions, of freedom and slavery together, of laughter and fear together. And it was a very, very difficult way of living. And yet, as I had said before, that it was a life that people became addicted to, because you didn't have to knuckle under to anybody there. It was a certain freedom that I had never known before or have never known since.
How long did you lead a hobo's life, and why did you decide to go home?
Only about 9 months, actually. Not even quite that long. I'd say about 8.5 months. And the reason I went home was that one of the hobos murdered a detective. And the two men who were involved in this happened to have been my friends. And one of them was caught. The man who'd murdered the hobo, the detective, the railroad detective, was caught and just plain beaten to death. And his friend got away, and I finally ran into him down into California, and he was almost dead at that time, too. He was an older man. And he talked to me for a minute and convinced me that I had to get off the road now. I could not stay on it and expect to get off it later on, that I'd been on long enough that I was going to become addicted to it, and I said, get off the road, go home, go back to school, and try to make something out of myself in the sense of the word of helping our people, as he told me, that you've learned the score now, and our people need young men who know the score, so go home. So I did. But I was very restless after I got home. I never fit into the kind of a life that I was forced to lead from then on.
Well, when you got home, I think you were 18, and you tucked your way back into school so you could finish your senior year and graduate high school.
Yes.
It must have been very difficult to adjust.
It was. It was. First of all, I lost a semester of school, and I felt much older and much coarser, much rougher, and much wiser than these young men and women that was now in my graduating class. I did have a very difficult time adjusting to them.
Nelson Peary is the author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. We'll continue this interview in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue Terry Gross's interview with Nelson Peary. Peary served with the all-black 93rd Infantry Division in the segregated army during World War II. Some black soldiers rioted in protest against the conditions black troops were subjected to. Peary enlisted to save freedom abroad, but the military made it very clear how little freedom he had at home. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Disclosure, the new film starring Michael Douglas and Demi Moore. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. White House officials now say Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders has been fired. Earlier, President Clinton's press secretary had said Elders resigned but would not give details. President Clinton says Elders had to go because she has made policy statements that conflict with his policies and convictions. White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta says Elders' departure was triggered by a comment she made that masturbation should be taught in schools. President Clinton welcomed diplomats from 34 Western Hemisphere nations to Miami today for the so-called Summit of the Americas. The gathering is aimed at opening new markets and strengthening the hemisphere's trend toward democracy. Mr. Clinton said he hoped that the next time the summit is held, Cuba will have joined the democratic movement.
Only one nation in our hemisphere is not represented here. It's the only one where democracy is still denied. We support the Cuban people's desire for peaceful, democratic change, and we hope that the next time we have one of these summits, and the people of all the Western Hemisphere send their leaders here, the leader of a democratic Cuba will take its place at the table of nations.
Representatives at the summit hope to make progress toward a free trade agreement for the hemisphere that would take effect by 2005. The Pentagon announced about $7.7 billion in cuts today in major weapons programs. Defense Secretary William Perry says the reductions are spread over 6 years. The budget cuts or delays programs including the Air Force's F-22 fighter jet, the Army's Comanche helicopter, and the Navy's new attack submarine. A Japanese official says President Clinton and the Japanese Prime Minister may meet next year as the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II approaches. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
Ambassador Takakazu Kuriyama, who is now in Japan, said a visit between the two leaders would help minimize whatever negative feelings the two nations have developed since Japan rose from the ashes of World War II. A meeting would help reconfirm the importance and lend direction to the bilateral relationship, which has suffered under the strain of perennial trade disputes and diplomatic miscues. In addition to being a salve for irritation caused by commemorations of the war, like the recent atomic bomb stamp row, the two leaders would discuss APEC, which Japan hosts next year. The environment and next steps in Japan's much-vaunted economic deregulation would presumably be discussed as well. Tokyo has informed Washington about possible dates and is now waiting for a reply. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Stocks closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added more than 5 points to close at 3691.11, but declines topped advances by a 4-3 margin in heavy trading of 336 million shares. This is NPR. European countries whose troops are working for the UN in Bosnia agreed today the peacekeepers should stay there as long as possible. France and Britain had been talking about a possible withdrawal, but European Union leaders meeting in Germany decided today not to pull the troops out yet. They said the troops are needed there as much as ever with winter coming on and food for civilians expected to be scarce. But NATO ambassadors meeting in Brussels today voted to go ahead with developing contingency plans for evacuating the peacekeepers. The incoming House Majority Leader Dick Armey says he supports the Clinton administration's decision to send U.S. troops to Bosnia if it becomes necessary to evacuate the U.N. peacekeepers. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Armey gave his qualified support for President Clinton's decision to make U.S. troops available to get U.N. peacekeepers out of Bosnia.
This is a nation that has always been willing to risk its peace to protect the freedom and safety of other peoples. This is a thing we can be proud of. But we always ought to take that risk in a well-defined, well-planned, well-executed, safe and secure manner.
Army says he'd like to talk to the president about the purpose of the mission before U.S. troops are ever deployed. Army says the Republican leadership was advised of the decision. They would rather have been consulted, but are not upset. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
Survivors say an electrical fault and a barricaded door in an auditorium have combined to cause a fire that killed more than 300 people in northern China. Most of the victims were children performing and watching a cultural show. Survivors report that the fire in the newly decorated hall began with sparks from the ceiling that ignited the stage curtains and exploded into balls of flames. An official report says one of the building's two doors had been blocked during the recent renovations. Chinese officials have been concerned that a rush to modernization has led to hurried construction and dangerous conditions. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with part two of our interview with Nelson Peery. He's written a new memoir called Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. In the first part of our show, he told us about the time he spent as a hobo during the Depression. He enlisted during World War II and served in the all-black 93rd Infantry Division of the Segregated Army. He wanted to fight to preserve justice abroad, even though he knew that as a black man, he couldn't hope for much justice at home. Did you ever feel when you joined the Army that you were part of a military that was fighting to preserve a way of life that you were fighting to change?
Yes, that was very clear. That was a very obvious thing, that the military was the mainstay of American reaction. There's no question about that. But at the same time, the military had to fight the worst threat to human freedom, and especially to the freedom of the colored peoples of the earth. That is to say, Hitler Germany. That the Army had to fight them, despite the fact that huge sections of the officer corps had no argument with what Germany was trying to do. And so it was a very contradictory thing. And, of course, the book, I think, shows as clearly as can be shown the terrible position that the black enlisted men were forced into in this segregated, Jim Crowed, Southern-led Army.
What was the work that you had to do compared to what your white counterpart had to do?
Well, first of all, just as simply as infantrymen in the United States, we all did about the same thing, right? We trained and we went to the rifle range and we walked endless miles and our tasks were about the same as the tasks of the white soldiers as long as we were in the United States. But when we got overseas, it was a completely different situation. And that is to say that the Army did not want to commit black soldiers to combat. And the reason for it is a very simple one, that they learned in World War I that they could not expect these black soldiers to go overseas, fight and die for a freedom that they never had, and then come back home and be compelled to go back to building levees, picking cotton, and doing the drudgery of America. So therefore, the only way to guarantee that the blacks would return to second-class citizenship was to guarantee that they were second-class soldiers. And this is what we were primarily fighting against.
In what way were you kept as second-class soldiers? What was second-class about your position?
Well, first of all, in relation to the white officers, I would say that the Army, when I went into the Army, the Army still had this position that the best officers for a black organization is Southern whites, that the Southern whites, in quotes, knows the Negro better. Mm-hmm. And what happened, really, is that the black organizations were fiefdoms for these white officers. They had servants. They were waited on hand and foot. They demanded a discipline from the black troops that was never expected from the white troops. And and of course, along with it, the terrible segregation of the black soldiers. For example, I was in the 369th Infantry of the 93rd Division, and we were stationed originally at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. There was absolutely no recreation at that post. That post was approximately 60 miles from the nearest town, whether it be Nogales or Phoenix or Bisbee. We were about 60 miles and no way to get into these towns. And when we could get into them, the segregation was such that we immediately got into fights and were barred from coming into these towns. And we had, as far as the USO was concerned, the USO never came near the black troops. Only towards the end of the war they began doing it. But in 1942, 1943 period, 1941, there was the generals absolutely were appalled at the idea of white women dancing to entertain black soldiers. So therefore, we didn't get any entertainment. I mean, this kind of segregation, and let alone the fact that except for when we went to Mexico, there was no way for us to have recreation. And got into terrible fights in Phoenix, you know, especially with the white soldiers or the 8th Air Force. And so it was a very difficult time for us. And yet I think that the reality was that it was not qualitatively different from what we are known as civilians.
Did you ever try to rebel?
There wasn't any sense of rebellion in the sense of the word of overthrowing something. But we were constantly being pulled into fights. And these fights in the beginning were just fights between soldiers, like between our relations with the 8th Air Force was notorious. And we fought them everywhere we went, in Bisbee and Phoenix and in Nogales. We got into fights with the 8th Air Force. When we went to Louisiana, there was some struggle against the white civilians. But the main thing of it was a general wave in 1943 when we were in Louisiana, the general wave of anti-black violence that was everywhere, not just in Louisiana and against the black soldiers. I mean, there was like the riot in Beaumont and Detroit. And when I say riot, I know that most of the people who hear this program think in terms of blacks uprising. That's not what riots were in the 1940s or the 1930s or 1920s. When you said riot, you meant white mobs invading the black community, burning the homes, killing the people, and with the police assisting them, of course. So we had this terrible riot in Beaumont, Texas, and the even worse riot in Detroit. And then, of course, other riots of a smaller dimension were everywhere else, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and so forth and so on. And it was this general frustration of being an armed soldier and living in a situation where these mobs were killing blacks, and we weren't able to come to their assistance because we couldn't get there. And this kind of frustration, you know, sometimes boiled up to the point where people began taking pot shots at other people. But it wasn't terribly widespread, although we were very close. We were prepared for a fight. Like, for example,
what did you do to prepare, and what were you expecting?
Well, first of all, by the time we left Fort Huachuca, Arizona, and we had already gotten a committee of people together in the three regiments of my division, the 25th Infantry, the 368th, and 369th. Only about 20 people in each of these regiments. But we met from time to time to discuss what we would do if we were attacked by the Klan or if a riot occurred in either Manny, Louisiana, or DeRidder, because these areas were close enough for us to get to. And so by the time we got to Louisiana, of course, the entire division was armed, I mean, with ammunition, that we expected the very worst when we got to Louisiana. And so we were prepared. And we kept our ammunition, buried it when we got to a bivouac area, dug it up when we left, but we were prepared to fight if the fight came down. Now, on the other hand, I should say that it's clear now that the secret services of the Army, that is to say the G2 department, and the counterintelligence corps, they operated amongst the police and the Klan and amongst the more reactionary sections of the peoples in Louisiana, warning them against any provocation against our division. Because they understood that if 18,000 soldiers, the number of men in my division, were pulled into some kind of action, you're not going to be dealing with an uprising, right? You're going to be dealing with a civil war. And so what happened, like in Camp Stewart, Georgia, where a group of white men surrounded three soldiers and demanded that they say yes, sir, to them. And these soldiers said, we're not going to do it. And this mob shot those three soldiers to death. Now, if that would have been, it happened around with our division, we would have undoubtedly been pulled into a quite broadly based action. And so the G2 department, I think, went out of its way to guarantee that this didn't happen by warning the Klan to stay away from us. Like in Camp Shelby, the Klan attacked the black troops and killed several of them. And other parts of Mississippi, there was attacks against black soldiers. But it was always an attack of a very large group of whites against a very small group of black soldiers. Well, we were not a small group, and we were armed. So, and the Klan, of course, and the rest of these fascists were a bunch of cowards. And if they were, you know, one by one, one on one, they wouldn't fight, right? They'd pull back. So we didn't get involved in directly, although we were at the edge of fighting, at the edge of uprisings, and at the edge of intervening in these riots from the time we got to Louisiana until the time we left.
My guest is Nelson Peary. He has a new memoir called The Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nelson Peary. I get the impression from your book that after being in battle, you started to feel like you were in danger of dehumanizing the Japanese in the same way that you felt whites had dehumanized blacks.
Yes, that's true. I mean, when you call somebody that you're killing, if you'll excuse me, a Jap bastard. Now, these are the same race of people, these young women that gave me the bushel of peas and hoped that I had good luck and helped me get out of this slave camp I was in, right? This is the same nationality. But you call him that name as you're killing this man. You know that what you're doing is setting him outside the human race. And you suddenly see that every white that called you a nigger and a black bastard, that they were setting you outside the human race so they could kill you without fear of retribution, either here or in the hereafter, right? And suddenly I realized in a real sense of the word, the oneness of humanity. And if I was going to fight the Japanese, I was going to fight them because their national effort was one that was in opposition to the well-being of the peoples of the earth, that they were the same fascists as that the German army was. But in no way was I ever going to again be pulled into this kind of a setting a human being outside of the human race that I did once in my life. It was a very, very traumatizing thing for me when I realized what I had done.
When you got home from the war, did you feel that black veterans were treated any differently than white veterans were? Did you feel like you got what you were supposed to from the GI Bill, for instance?
What happened in 1919 with the coming home of World War I veterans, what they call the Red Summer, this summer of lynchings and beatings and burnings and brutality, to force them back to the plantations, back to keep picking cotton, back to building levees. They did to a less extent after World War II. Like, the best example I can give to you is Sergeant Woodward, who was on his way back home south on the bus. And when they got to the Mason-Dixon line, he was ordered to go to the back of the bus. He said, "I was in the front lines. I'm not going to the back of the bus." And when the cops got him, they beat him senseless and gouged his eyes out. Even Truman had to say, this can't go on. Mm-hmm. And Truman was for segregation. As whether he did away with it in the Army or not, he was committed to segregation. But at any rate, there was all kinds of lynchings and brutalities and police killings. I mean, even people like Omar Bradley, General Omar Bradley, who was supposed to be the great GI general, he was such a militant segregationist, it wasn't funny. And at the end of the war, when he was head of the Army, you know, I mean, he enforced to the letter every bit of segregation in the veterans' hospitals and in the Army that he could possibly do. And he was one of the better generals. And so, yes, we were treated very badly at the end of the war, and it's one of the reasons that I completed my leftward motion, my leftward journey, I think, was to realize that there was no way that we could get through this thing in a simple and peaceful manner.
Your memoir, Black Fire, ends after you come home from the military. And on the last page, you write that you decided you would use the GI Bill of Rights and learn to fight another way. Did you?
Well, I went to the University of Minnesota for a year and a half. And by the end of that year and a half, the McCarthy period had really set in. And I became convinced that I couldn't be a serious revolutionary and a professional at the same time. So I quit school and learned the bricklayer's trade and became a bricklayer and maintained myself as a revolutionary over these years.
When you say revolutionary, what do you mean?
I mean to say, if participating in the organized revolutionary movement for about 10 years, I was a member of the Communist Party, and I was thrown out of that in 1954, really. And from then on, I participated in various other organizations. Right now, I'm one of the national officers of the National Organizing Committee that is committed to change in the United States based upon robotics, based upon the fact that the capitalist system can no longer survive. It can't maintain itself with the new means of production. So I've always been in revolutionary work ever since I was actually 16 or 17 years old, and have continued. Sometimes I had to change how and what I was doing, but I maintained myself in this. I might say just finally that when we talk about a revolutionary, we're not talking about throwing gasoline bombs or, you know, shouting in the middle of the street. We're talking about trying to find out what are the objective, if I could say so, and human factors that are involved in change. And when you see these factors available, how do you go about working with them? Like, again, as I want to refer to the question of the economic revolution that's taking place in the United States, it's bound to be followed by a social reorganization or a social revolution. The role of the revolutionary today is to guarantee that the poor people, the downtrodden, come out as the rulers of America.
How do you make a living now?
Oh, I'm 71 years old now, and I'm retired. And hopefully the book will help me pull the strings together. But I live on my Social Security, which isn't very much, as you can imagine.
You wrote this book many years ago and then picked it up and started editing it or rewriting it?
Well, I rewrote it some. Of course, when I first wrote it, I was only about 24 years old, and it was a very much of an ideological statement. And, of course, there was no way to get it published during the McCarthy period. So I just set it aside and basically forgot about it until about a year ago when I found it and reread it and handed it to my wife, and she reread it, she read it, first time she'd seen it. And we decided, hey, I should take a little time off and try to rewrite this, which I did. And I was really surprised when I sent it into the new press, and they accepted it right away.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your story with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you much.
Nelson Peary is the author of Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel joins us to talk about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Barbara. Today we'll be hearing news of defense cuts announced by Defense Secretary William Perry, also about the resignation of Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders, and we'll be hearing from three freshman members of Congress, all Republicans, all taking part in the Heritage Foundation's preparation course for Congress up in Baltimore. We'll hear what they have been hearing about and what they make of it all.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. During the late 80s, Barry Levinson delivered a 1-2 punch that made him one of the most sought-after directors in Hollywood. The enormous hit Good Morning Vietnam in 1987 and the big Oscar winner Rain Man in 1988. But his next picture, Bugsy, in 1991, was mild at the box office, and the two movies after that, Toys and Jimmy Hollywood, were out-and-out disasters. Now on the lookout for a hit, he's adapted Michael Crichton's latest bestseller. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Disclosure.
Speaking of Disclosure, let me admit right up front that this movie's screenwriter, Paul Attanasio, is an old friend and colleague of mine. By the current standards of the journalistic community, that would ordinarily mean I'm going to say lots of terrible things about him. But I'm not. Attanasio wrote the screenplay for Quiz Show, which I liked a lot, and though Disclosure's a much trashier movie, Attanasio's done a bang-up job with it. His script is funny and twisty and inventive, and the movie that Barry Levinson has built around it is very entertaining. The subject, as you might have heard, is sexual harassment, but no one here is doing any heavy lifting. This is a suspense movie about corporate maneuvering, and sexual harassment is just one of the pawns in the villain's endgame. That villain is Meredith Johnson, a woman on the rise in a Seattle computer company. She's played by Demi Moore as the ultimate female power ranger, out to demolish the man she's just been promoted over. He is Tom Sanders, played by Michael Douglas in his now standard role, the white middle-class American male as victim. 10 years earlier, deep in Silicon Valley, Tom and Meredith had had a torrid affair. But now Tom is happily married to someone else, and he's a settled company man. When Meredith calls him to her office after hours for a first consultation, new boss to new subordinate, he willingly goes. But Meredith doesn't have computers on her mind.
Get down to business.
Wait a second.
There, was that so bad?
No, that's not so bad, but it's just...
Come on, while there's still a chance we might get caught.
Meredith.
No. Oh, yes, I think so.
Meredith, no.
Meredith. No, some things never change. Some things just get better.
Meredith, come on. Oh.
By one count, Tom says no 31 times in that scene. But to Meredith, no doesn't mean no. And the next morning, Tom finds that she's taken her revenge on him for refusing her. In short, she's accusing him of sexual harassment. The filmmakers, like Michael Crichton before them, have figured that if you perform a role reversal on sexual harassment, it'll throw all the issues into high relief. And so it does. But that doesn't mean you have to linger on any of this. And wisely, disclosure doesn't. The movie makers may have hit upon something. Despite all the huffing and puffing from extremists on both sides of the issue, it's likely that most of the audience has already reached a consensus on sexual harassment. On the one hand, you don't use power to coerce sexual favors. On the other hand, consensual office flirting is no crime. And the gray area in between those two poles is just that, a gray area, requiring sensitivity on both sides. The movie makers know we'll have more fun watching the corporate intrigue. And most of the film is about Meredith's moves to get Tom fired and Tom's counter moves to unseat her. In between, there's a lot of very showy falderal involving the company's new computer technology, which looks great in a movie, though it would be utterly ludicrous in real life. It allows you to stand on a special platform wearing a huge goggly headset while light beams flash around you. Also, you can perform operations I can do just fine now with two fingers. As for Barry Levinson, well, he can be ponderous when he's working on his pet projects. But when he's directing a big commercial thriller like this one, he's terrific. The camera whooshes around the computer company's glass walls and mysterious staircases like a voyeur on wings, and the atmosphere of secrecy and suspense is electric. Disclosure is a much less significant motion picture than it might have been, and therefore, a lot more fun.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Today's program was produced by Roberta Shurrock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Updike and Alan Tu. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our intern is Sienna Chrisman. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, forensic psychiatrist Park Dietz. His life work has been to understand some of America's most notorious criminal minds, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Hinckley, and Joel Rifkin. Dietz is a consultant on a new HBO special on workplace violence. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.